with our brother talk today. And I'll just ask people to strike again. So the first day I talked about the breath, about present moment awareness. Second day about silence. The third day about the breath. And before I go on to what happens next, I just wanted to mention that when you do walking meditation, just like when you do present moment awareness and silence, just everything gets very still, and the only thing left is what's moving, being the breath going in and out. Similar with walking meditation, you're walking there, just being in the present moment, being silent, and the only thing which is left once you stop thinking, when everything gets still, is what's moving, and that is your feet. So it happens naturally, but if you want to invite the feeling in your feet into the meditation, you can, because the next stage in walking meditation, you're in the present moment, you're silent, and then you start to become aware of the movement in your feet and in your legs. You start to be able to become sensitive to the feeling in your feet against the red carpet. You can actually become more sensitive and just know what it's like. And you start to notice when your feet lift up from the carpet, and what part of the foot leaves the carpet first, and how there's a whole series of movements for just one foot lifting up above the carpet. And just as the leg moves further up, and as the weight changes to be on the other leg, so your free leg can move forward, you can notice all those sensations of a leg moving forward. And then you can feel it as it goes onto the ground. And the first sensation of when the first part of the foot meets the carpet, and then the next part until the foot is resting on the carpet, and then your weight transfer to that foot so the other foot can move. There's so many sensations. And that's the only thing which is moving. So that's what you focus on. So what that does in walking meditation, it means that after a while, all you're really aware of is just the movement of the feet and the legs. Just like in breath meditation, all you're aware of is just the breath going in and going out. Just the left leg going forward, the right leg going forward. And that becomes a walking meditation. That's what you focus on. And as you start focusing on just the sensations of moving, always in the present moment, always silent, not having a commentary, but just being with those sensations, it becomes very interesting and also very delightful. In the same way when you're meditating on the breath, after a while it becomes delightful. It's a, it's a beautiful breath, it's an enjoyable breath. You just like staying there, you're having a good time. In the same way thing happens in a walking meditation. Now for some of you will prefer walking meditation, some of you will prefer sitting meditation. And the rest of you will prefer sleeping meditation and eating meditation. But walking meditation is good because when you're walking, you don't have any aches and pains in the body. No leg aches, no knee aches, no back aches. That is why for many people they prefer walking meditation. And they can get very peaceful and very happy. So what you're doing, you're focusing quite naturally, not through force, just on the experiences of walking, and you get very, very focused just within this walking. And everything else in the world just totally disappears as you're happily just walking backwards and forwards. So that's actually how we focus. Now with the breath meditation, and just carry on as long as you like, I should have mentioned earlier that one of the reasons why you start getting happy is because that's the nature of the mind when you don't do so much work. The more still you are, the more happiness you have. Because that type of happiness, for those of you who have listened to my teachings before, you know, that is the happiness of the mind. It is when that happiness, that energy of the mind, is not wasted doing so much and thinking so much. It's like you have this huge resource of energy, which is not being used in making decisions and working out the meaning of life and thinking about how you can get back at that person who banged the door this morning. And when you're not worried about anything whatsoever, you're not trying to get enlightened. When you're not doing anything, you're not wasting energy. And so what happens is all that energy spills up in the mind. The teaching is the two halves of the mind, the doing mind and the knowing mind, otherwise known as the active mind and the passive mind, in Pali, the Sankhara and the Vijnana. That which knows and that which does. And unfortunately, in human beings in our modern world, they do so much that there's so much energy is wasted in doing things which you don't really need to do, in thinking thoughts which lead nowhere, in activity which all it does is make you tired. And we think, we plan, we do so much that our poor brain has hardly got any energy left at all. People who worry a lot, think a lot, they're the ones who get depressed. And all that depression is the mind has run out of energy. It just doesn't want to do anything anymore. It's just really, really low energy. And one of the best ways of overcoming that is just be still. What I usually say, enjoy your depression. Think of all the benefits of being depressed. You don't have to get up early in the morning. You don't have to go to work. People look after you. You don't have to wash the dishes. You're depressed, so people will look after you. So it's a very, very good way to be lazy. So when you really enjoy, when you really enjoy it, and sort of see if you can beat your record of how many days you can be depressed, when it's really interesting for you, then of course you're not depressed anymore. So, all it really is just a lack of energy, and fighting these things just wastes more energy. Which is why that all the things we've taught in this retreat, just letting things be, making peace, being kind, being gentle, that's not doing anything. Which means the energy starts to come back into your brain and into your mind. You actually wake up. It's very nice just walking from the teacher's cottage just after breakfast here. There's a mist over Jhana Grove. It's very spooky. It's good job that mist wasn't there last night. Otherwise, in the mist, very strange beings waft in and out of the mist. But you don't have to worry. I remember just when I was a kid in London, they had these really, the last of those really big fogs. You know, they called them pea super fogs. I mean, literally, I couldn't see from here to over there. You couldn't see at all. It was just such a thick mist. I remember going to school one morning, in a primary school. We'd always play soccer in the playground. And I managed to get the ball. You know, we're playing soccer. I managed to get the ball. And of course, no one could find me or the ball, because it's a big mist. And I found the goal. I kept scoring goal one after the other until I figured out, hey, no one's watching me. It doesn't really matter. I was really disappointed in that. Because, you know, if you're going to score a goal, the main thing is not scoring the goal, but everybody's seeing you. It's all about pride. But in the mist, after an hour or two when the sun comes up, all the mist vanishes and it's clear again. Another beautiful, clear day at Jhana Grove. And that mist is like tiredness. You don't need to blow the mist away. Just the sun of stillness and kindness, the warmth of kindness. After a while, the mists in the mind vanish. And everything becomes clear. You become energized. It is through stillness you get this mental energy. And that mental energy is the very same thing as happiness. If I'm a bubbly monk who's playful and tells silly jokes, I can't help it. Sometimes in meditation you get so much energy, it bubbles up into the next stupid joke. It's just energy of the mind. That's why, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You can tell how good my meditation is by how exuberant are those sadhus. If I've been really dull in meditation, it's sadhu. So, sadhu. Imagine that good meditation. Sadhu, sadhu. It's the mental energy which comes up, and it's happiness. So this is what comes up when you really become still. So when we talk about delightful breath, or the delightful walking meditation, that is a natural consequence of you creating a lot of stillness, and the energy starting to come back into your body and mind. You feel good. You feel happy, energized, clear. And that's just a wonderful state to be in. And it only comes up if you're still. So don't go thinking about too many things. Don't go working out the meaning of life, or, you know, whether Ajahn Brahm taught the right thing or the wrong thing, or whether the person sitting next to you is enlightened or they're not enlightened, or whether you're stupid or whether you're... Shut up! And be still. And if you can have that stillness, the happiness grows and grows and grows. In the middle of the retreat, you're really buzzing with a big smile on your face, and you really, really feel happy just because of the stillness. So that makes the meditation really happy. You're actually enjoying it. It is good fun. And so you're sitting there watching the breath, and the breath becomes a delightful breath. You just can't keep your eyes off it. It's just delightful. You just want to stay there because the body is at peace, and the body and the mind is happy. And then what happens is the breath, as I said yesterday, starts to get very calm, very even, and then it disappears. It's one less thing to disturb the stillness. Your body has gone. Bye-bye, body. It's very encouraged to let go of this body. I don't matter how young or old, fit or ill you are, all bodies ache. And because of that, it's wonderful to be able to say, bye-bye, body, I'm going on holiday. And that's what happens. Your body vanishes and disappears. You can't feel your legs. You can't feel your head. Your nose no longer itches because there's no nose left. And it's brilliant when that happens because it's called in meditation in Pali, kaya pasadi, the tranquility of the body, the calming of the body. The body has been so calmed down, it vanishes. And so all you have left is that sixth sense, the mind. Now for some people, when their body disappears, they go into like a blank state. Yeah, they feel peaceful, but there's nothing much happening. And they come up to me in their interviews and said, yeah, my body disappeared, but what should I watch? What should I watch? And the answer is, it's whatever's there. Are you conscious? Yeah. So you must be conscious of something. Find out what that is and watch that. So don't choose. But it's also the case, they never put enough happiness into the breath. For some reason or another, they didn't develop the delightful breath enough. Because what usually happens, when the breath disappears, the delight is what's left. The happiness. There is such a great difficulty finding similes to explain these deep states of meditation, simply because not many people go to those states. So there is not this great resource of similes and metaphors. But I got one metaphor for this particular stage which is very accurate. And that's a simile from Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. And those of you who know Alice in Wonderland, I thought there was a movie about it recently. I hope it was accurate to the book. But in Alice in Wonderland, in the book, there is the episode where Alice sees this Cheshire Cat suddenly appear on a tree branch. And then the Cheshire Cat suddenly disappears. And then suddenly appears again. And Alice sort of complains to the cat, all this this appearing and disappearing. It's making me quite giddy. Stop it, cat. And so the Cheshire Cat replies, okay, I will vanish slowly for you instead of so fast. And with Alice watching this cat, first the tail disappears, and then the legs, and then the body, leaving only the head, and then the ears disappear, and then the whiskers disappear, and then the whole head disappears, leaving only the smile, with not even lips to do the smiling. And Alice replies, or says, this is really weird. I've often seen a cat without a smile, but I've never before seen a smile without a cat. Now that was a very, very smart piece of English literature, but it was very accurate to what happens in meditation. The smile is what's left, with nothing to do the smiling. It's not a happy breath, it's just the happiness without the breath. The body has disappeared, just like the Cheshire Cat, leaving only the smile, the mental experience of happiness. Now, if you develop the delightful breath, as I've been teaching, and if the breath is peaceful but not delightful, a lot of time it is because you've rejected the happiness. You may not have seen that, but somehow or other you've got the teaching, if you're enjoying it, it must be bad for you. That happiness can't have anything to do with enlightenment. Happiness will make you attached. Happiness is dangerous. And unfortunately, many teachers teach that, and it's really wrong. The happiness is part of the path. It's written there in the suttas. It's what happens. It's meant to happen. It's supposed to happen. Encourage it. So when the happiness does come, don't let it go. Let it be. And there's a subtle difference between letting go and letting be. Letting go carries with a rejection. No, go away. Letting be means you allow it to exist. So when the happiness comes, allow it to exist. Let it be. Don't let it go. What you're really supposed to be letting go of is this thing in here, which does all the work. The controller, the doer, that's what you're letting go of. What you're experiencing out here, that is what you let be. You let go of the controller, the object of your meditation, that's what you let be. You don't interfere with it. So, if you do that and some happiness comes up, let it be. It develops. As I said yesterday, if the happiness hasn't come, try a little bit of a smile. That's also one of the reasons I try and create a little bit of happiness with a bit of lightness in the meditation. Telling jokes, making you laugh. Now that's not just having fun with you. That's on purpose, to bring you happiness on this retreat. But I know that some retreats, people have told me, there's not any laughter at all. The teacher never tells a joke. The teacher only tells you off. Which means even the attitude, the opening for happiness in the retreat is closed off. That's why I love telling meditation jokes, like the walking meditation joke. Now I'm very pleased to say, as Buddhism establishes itself in the West, in modern Western culture, we have real Buddhist jokes and meditation jokes, authentic. This is part of embedding itself in the culture. And the walking meditation joke, if you haven't heard it before, you're going to hear it again anyway. There was one person who just finished their meditation retreat, and they went back to work. And they were working in Singapore Zoo after their meditation retreat. And when they came back to work, they were just so peaceful, so calm. Even walking, they were so mindful, they can feel their left foot move up and move forward and move down as they came in the office for work. And when they talked to their boss, good morning, boss, mindful of every movement. And her boss thinks, oh God, what can I do with this guy this morning? Now the boss, you know, if you get to be a boss of something like Singapore Zoo, you know, you have to be very smart. And he said, I've got the best job for you today. Until you come down from, you know, your big zombie meditator. You can look after the tortoise enclosure. The appropriate job for someone who's just come off meditation retreat. So the guy said, all right, I will look after the tortoises. And so he started walking mindfully to the tortoise enclosure. And at lunchtime, the zookeeper decided to check up on him. And you know what he found? The gate of the tortoise enclosure was open. And all the tortoises had escaped. And he said, what happened? The tortoises have gone. And the meditator said, well, I just opened the door and whoosh. That's one of my stupid jokes. But it makes you happy, okay? And it brings this joy to your meditation. So you can actually get better meditation. And so if your meditation is getting very dull, just think of that joke. It doesn't make you depressed, it'll get you into the next stage of meditation. Which is, when you've got enough mental energy, when you've got enough mental energy, because the happiness, remember, the happiness is energy. The energy is happiness. So it means that when you've got a delightful breath, you've got an energized mind. Peaceful, but energized. Which means that when the breath disappears, it's not sort of, you know, what the hell am I watching? It's bright. It's easy to see. It's the world of the nimittas. The world of the mental objects. So those nimittas. It's amazing, the most common thing which people see at first, if they follow the instructions, they've got a happy, bright mind, is they see this like a screen of light. So the mind is bright, so it's like you see this whole screen of light, brightness. It doesn't matter what colour these things are. That's good, I mean, it shows that your mind is energised. You're not seeing light because your eyes aren't working anymore. It's not the sense of sight, it's the mind. And the trouble with describing these things is you're describing things which belong to the mental world, and the only way we can explain it with similes with the physical world. So it's sort of like light, but it's not light. That's just the way we perceive it and interpret it. Now that's the usual way if you follow the instructions. And then what happens is as usual, it's not an even screen of light. It's never an even screen of light. There's always one part of that screen which is more beautiful than the rest. And you train yourself, or rather I train you, because in this particular state of mind, all that brainwashing by your teachers is very powerful and effective. The sorts of things I did when I got into those nimitta stages, I was really surprised. How did I do that? And after a while you reflect back, you get insight. My goodness, it was Ajahn Chah told me to do that. He put these seeds, these instructions into my mind. He programmed it. So when I got to these stages, I thought it was me doing this stuff. No, it was not. He programmed me. And even that little instruction in that screen, you will see that part of that screen will be one part which is brighter than the next. Go to that part of the screen. Go to the more beautiful part, the brightest part. You don't have to do anything anymore. I put that into your brain, and you will do that. Because in the deep meditation, you're so sensitive that these pieces of instruction which you get from your teachers, they're very, very effective. Now you don't have to worry. Whenever that screen comes up, quite naturally, you go to the more beautiful part. And of course, that will start expanding. And you get this beautiful nimitta, this beautiful focus light. Like a disc of a moon or whatever, star, whatever. Now those are the very useful limiters. However, sometimes not only do people get just a blankness at first of all, and they just got to wait in that blankness until some beautiful limiter comes out, it's the happiness and energy is what's lacking for such people. But sometimes people get sort of what we call complicated limiters. And they're the limiters, those mental images of like scenery, beautiful rolling hills, mountains, rooms, buildings, mansions, people. There's no end to what the mind can create. And all that tells me is, yes, you know, you've let go of the body, you've got into this mental world, but your mind is still too complicated. Instead of having a simple image, it's really complicated with hills and trees and flowers and weeds. But what to do with that mental image, again, is very simple. Find a part of that image which is more beautiful than the rest. I remember once I got one of these images of rolling hills and nice trees. But you notice that one of the leaves on one of the trees had a dewdrop on it, and it twinkled. Look for the twinkly part. And if you just focus on that twinkle, it just became this huge, beautiful limiter. So somewhere in that scenery, there's a bright, what I call the twinkle in that that image. It was like a stream, there's always one little twinkly part of the stream. You know, a part of the wave or the ripple which reflects the sun. There's always something which is brighter and beautiful. And just allow the mind just to go straight to that. It will open up and you'll have a very, very nice limiter. There are also sometimes that people have these limiters and they are scary limiters. And that's because you've had a scary mind. Usually because, you know, you're full of fear and negative and stuff like that. You've had a bad day, you got angry at somebody or whatever, and that sort of reflects in your limiter. So, there has been people who in their meditation see monsters. Scary demons coming to take over your mind. I remember a girl, a Perth girl from Vic Park. She came and told me about her demon, which came up in her meditation. And the demon said, "I've come to take over your mind." And she was quite perturbed. She was upset. She was scared. She was terrified. So she came to see me. I said, "Look, come on. If a demon was coming to take over your mind, they would not warn you about it. That's like a burglar knocking on your house. 'Excuse me, sir, I'm coming to rob your house tonight.' What burglar in their right mind would do that? What demon would do that?" So I say, that's the dead giveaway. That's not a real demon. That's you trying to scare the shit out of yourself. So listen, the next time that demon comes up to you, "I've come to take over your mind," tell that demon, "You're welcome. It doesn't belong to me." Have fun! Or do what I did when I got... Only once in my meditation did I see a monster as a limiter in that deep state. Only once. And that monster, I'll never forget it. You know, its tongue was hanging out. And it had all these fangs. You know, not teeth. Big, big, sharp fangs. Dripping red stuff. And its eyes were just like half out of its head. Huge, googly eyes, and you know its eyebrows were really sharp and pointed in. It was very angry, and its hair was all spiky. This was actually before the punks. You know, this was that's where the punks actually got their hairstyle from. You know, from the, actually, I know a joke about the punks. Oh, I can't refuse this joke. This is a very good funny story. Maybe if you've heard this one before, but it's a great one about this. This old man was. Maybe 50 or 60. He was in one of the railway carriages. Yeah, we are old, 50, 60 years old. He's in one of these mass transit railway carriages sitting opposite a punk. And this punk had big spiky hairs, about 3 or 4 colors, pink, green, all fluorescent. And he had, razor blades coming from one ear and sort of other needles come from the other ear. And his clothes were multi different colors, you know, with a bra on the outside and half a pair of trousers and all very different colors. And this guy was looking at him, and the punk said, "What are you looking at? Have you ever done anything strange in your life when you were young?" And the old man said, "Actually, yes. When I was in the Navy, I had sex with a parrot. I was thinking you might be my son." It's your fault. People give me all these joke books. And I can't, help read them. I've got a good memory for funny jokes. Anyway, this demon came up in my meditation. And so the playful attitude which I'm teaching you here, that's how you overcome these things. This big, you know, very, very scary monster. And straight away I put these Ray-Bans over its eyes. It blacked out like it was like Ray Charles or whatever. And then I blacked out a few of its fangs, so it needed to go to a dentist. You know, just I used to do this for those of you who are naughty school children like myself. You get pictures, you used to doodle on them and black them out and do funny things to them. And I put a cigarette out of its mouth, a straw hat over its spiky head. And you know, after a few minutes, because I knew that I'd created this image, that's what an imitator is, it's a creation of your mind. I knew I created this, so I could mess around with it. And I messed around with it. You know, these sunglasses, the cigarette blacking out a few of its teeth, and a straw hat, oh, with a flower coming out of it. And that demon looked so ridiculous that I laughed. And that demon never came back again. I knew that it was just my own mind creating this fear, and I knew how to deal with fear. I played with it and humiliated it. And I've taught that to many, many people. If you have a scary experience, you know, at this type of meditation, play around with it. Make it funny. Doodle with it. See the funny side of it. And straight away, what you're doing is you're taking away this fear and this negativity, and you're putting this laughter and joy and fun into that nimitta. And the part of it which is scaring you just vanishes. You're putting energy, positive energy into it, and you have a wonderful time afterwards. So that's what I do. And I gave that nimitta, that demon, sort of a funny hat, and it straight away it vanished. And then you get a proper nimitta, real beautiful nimittas. Now the real beautiful nimittas, once you get these complicated nimittas or negative nimittas, once you learn how to deal with those, and you get the beautiful nimittas, then they can become very bright. How, maybe for some of you, maybe first of all, yeah, you can see a light there, but it's dull. You know, it's not really, really intense. The reason is, again, not enough energy, not enough happiness. So your job, just stay with it. Be still. And the stillness builds up the energy. So after a while, you know, I know how to deal with this nimitta. So you just maybe have a dull nimitta first of all. You just stay with it. Don't try and do anything. My job is to be still. To let go of the doer and let the image just be. Totally content, not wanting it to develop. Because that's going off into the future. Right in this present moment, just be happy I've got an imitator. And then, the more still I am, the more it starts to grow in intensity. Basically, I'm feeding it energy. If I start to do something, I take the energy away. And it gets dull again. So I'm totally still. It gets brighter. And brighter. And brighter. And brighter. And it happens in these limiters that sometimes it gets really intensely bright. Just like going out looking at the sun. And a few times this happened to me, and it might happen to you, so this is why I talk to you about it. Sometimes you think, my goodness, this is too intense. I can't carry on watching this. I'm going to go blind. You don't go blind. You're not seeing it with your eyes. It's a mental object. And it can be brighter than a million suns, and you're fine with it. Nothing goes wrong. In fact, everything goes right. Because the brighter it is, also the happier it is. The more intense is the joy. And that's the other thing which sometimes happens. Sometimes you think, I can't take any more bliss. Stupid idea, isn't it? What do you mean? Can't take any more bliss. You can. There's no limit to the amount of ecstasy. I'm not talking about the pill, I'm talking about the real thing. There's no limit to the amount of ecstasy which you can experience. The more the better. So sometimes that limit gets incredibly bright, incredibly beautiful. But for many people, when the limiter comes up, they get excited or they get afraid. Remember, the fear thing is because you're losing control. Wonderful, it's about time you gave up control. You've been in control of your body and your meditation for too long. You've always messed up and stuffed up. So how about trying to let go and stop controlling things and just see what happens when you do nothing? Because you have to be very, very still when these nimittas appear. Because if you do anything at all, the nimitta wobbles and disappears. And the simile, the best simile, which again you cannot improve upon, was Ajahn Chah's still forest pool. That simile was when he went wandering in the jungles, you know, as a monk seeking solitude. And I did that for a while as well. There were still jungles when I was a young monk. You could go in these jungles and you'd be wandering around, but you'd always try and find a river, a lake, or some well in the afternoon, because you need to wash. There's a few days, you know, in Thailand you didn't wash, and because of the hot climate, you know, you really felt terrible on your body. You know, maybe over here in Australia it's not so sort of humid and hot. You know, you can go without a shower for a day or two. But over sort of in those parts of the world, no. You really need to shower. So you find a source of water, you bathe, and maybe you have to wash a couple of robes, you know, rinse them out, because they're also sweaty and dirty. More importantly, to get some water for drinking. So we always had to carry a water filter, so we could use the rivers and the lakes, you know, for a source of drinking water. And once you've done all of that, you just sit meditation for the night. We had these mosquito nets which you draped around an umbrella, and you sit there meditating. You know, in the evening. Now, sometimes inside your meditation umbrella, sometimes you keep your eyes open, because in the evening the jungle animals will come out to play, and it was also a great form of entertainment, just like people watch these nature channels. And you see these wild animals playing around, and it's like delightful. I like telling the story. I wasn't in the, well, it was in a jungle, but in a hut in the jungle in north of Thailand. And there was a little hole in the wood, like it was a knot hole in the wood cladding of my hut. And I would put a little bowl of water out for the birds, and I'd look at them through the hole to see what they would do when they were drinking and washing. Now this was jungle in the north of Thailand. There's hardly any human beings there at all. So these were really wild birds. After a couple of days they found that water, and after 3 days I couldn't believe my eyes. I wish I could have taken a photograph of this. Those birds, all from different species, would know there was water there every evening, and they'd come to drink and to wash. The weird thing was they would all stand in line in a queue. All these different species of birds, one after the other, maybe 10 or 12, in a line, one after the other. And they'd wait for the one in front to drink and wash, and then the next one in the queue would actually do his drinking and washing. I've never seen birds of different species organize themselves so well. I know in places like Singapore they do that, but not in Thailand. It's true, isn't it? You know. As soon as the buzz comes, first. But what happened was, many evenings, there was a new bird would come, and they would jump the queue. They'd go right into the water first, and all the other birds in line, all together, they would get out of the queue, jump on that bird, beat him up, send him away, and as soon as they got rid of the queue jumper, then they would all go back peacefully in the line, as they were before. It was weird, but it's true, that's what happened. So like, this is what happens, you know, when you actually watch nature, which hasn't been interfered with by human beings. It's delightful and so funny. So Ajahn Chah would do this, so he told me. He'd sit in his hut, and in the evening, he'd keep his eyes open to watch the animals come out and play. But, he said, because this was jungles, and the only human beings the animals were used to were hunters. Hunters who would kill them. So the animals were afraid of humans. They were terrified of them. In the same way that you might be afraid of a snake or of a tiger in the jungle. So when those animals came out, they would look around and they would sniff. And if they noticed Ajahn Chah was there, they wouldn't know he was a monk. They would think he was a hunter and run away terrified, even though they were thirsty. They would not come out. If Ajahn Chah was perfectly still, which he knew how to do, they would look around. Because he didn't move, they couldn't see him. And they would come out with their young to play, to drink by that pool, and he would enjoy it so much. They'd only come out if he was motionless. If he said, "Ooh, that's interesting," they would hear him, run away and not come out again. And he said sometimes he was so still, not the ordinary jungle animals, but very strange animals. Animals which his friends, his parents, his teachers had never told him existed. Weird, beautiful animals would come out only when he was perfectly still. And they'd play by the still forest pool, and he would enjoy watching them so much. That was his simile of the still forest pool. The pool meant his mind, and the animals meant the nimittas and the jhanas. They only come out if they can't see anybody watching. If you keep perfectly still, just like an Ajahn Chah in the jungle watching the animals come out in the evening, if you're perfectly still, they won't see you. And you catch them in nature, these beautiful nimittas playing in your mind. The jhanas, weird, very strange and amazingly beautiful things which few people know about. They only come out when you're perfectly still. That's why it's an incredibly beautiful and accurate simile of what happens. Because many of you have experienced that. You see a nimitta, as soon as you try and do anything, the nimitta either wobbles and just disappears. Sometimes you get excited, something's about to happen, and it disappears. Sometimes you're afraid, ooh, and it disappears. You've got to be perfectly still. Indeed, I sometimes describe this whole meditation process as more and more demanding exercises or tests in stillness. To go to the next stage, you have to pass an increasingly more subtle test on how to be still. Just to be able to sit on the ground with your eyes closed. Some people can't even do that. They haven't passed a basic test of stillness. Just being able to sit down for a few minutes. And then you've got to be able to still the time. Otherwise you'll always be thinking about past and future and you never get anywhere. But once you pass that test, then you get the test of silence. Can you actually let go of this thinking mind, always making comments and taking notes, and just watch in silence? And if you get enough good marks on that test, then you can watch the breath. But can you watch the breath with such stillness that it disappears. If you pass that test, then you get the harder test of nimitta test, which is much harder than watching the breath. Watching the breath, you don't have to be that still. You have to be pretty still to watch it continuously for many, many minutes. But it's even more requirement of stillness, and even deeper and more solid stillness, to be able to watch a nimitta. And it doesn't disappear. It just stays there. And that's actually the nimitta gives you feedback. If the nimitta moves, you're moving. If you're still, the nimitta is still. This was again one of those insights I got when I was playing around with nimittas and trying to keep them still. You know what I would do, like most other people do? When the nimitta was moving up there, or just now it was here, now it was gone, I tried to force it to be still. The more I forced it, the more it would just disappear or keep moving. And then I realized, I think I was just shaving my beard in the mirror, you know, one morning. And I realized, when you're looking in a mirror, and the image in the mirror is moving backwards and forwards, it's not the mirror's fault, it's the one who's watching's fault. And I realized that if the image in the mirror was moving, and I tried to hold the mirror still, it wouldn't have any effect at all. It's not the mirror's fault. The mirror wasn't moving, I was moving, the watcher. So if you have a nimitta, and the nimitta is unstable, it's because you're unstable, this being who's watching. So the idea was, as soon as I realized the nimitta was moving because I was moving, I paid attention to the nimitta, but I also paid attention to the one who's watching, and tried to keep that still. And when the one who was watching was kept still, the nimitta became still. You have to be like an Ajahn Chah by the pool, perfectly still. Don't do anything. It's because of such reasons that, you know, I keep on teaching people, just don't do anything in meditation. Just sit there and shut up and just allow the whole process to happen. In the beginning of the meditation, just present moment awareness and silence, even watching the breath, yeah, you can interfere. It's not that subtle of a few words of saying, no, come on, go back to the breath. That really doesn't affect you that much because the mind isn't that subtle. You can give instructions. You can interfere. You can actually tell, you know, the mind is often the thought, stop it, come back onto the breath. That's okay, that works. But the deeper you are in the meditation, the more important it is, you can't interfere at all. You really do have to let go. Take your hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, let go big time, full time, 100%, otherwise it doesn't work. You have to do that. It's testing you, what real letting go is. And the reward is that nimitta stays perfectly still. And because of its stillness, it grows in intensity. Incredible energy, incredible happiness. Now you're really getting into the meditation and understanding what it can do for you. Those nimittas are powerful. And if you want to sort of get interested in psychic power stuff, you know, you're beginning to get into it in that particular stage. You can feel the energy, incredible mental power. You know, huge. And that's your experience. But you've got to be still. If you do something, it all falls apart. And that's the nimitta stages of the meditation. Sometimes that people don't see visual nimittas, it becomes feely-feely nimittas. They have the bliss, but they don't see any light. In such people, it could be a nimitta, it may not be a nimitta. It's very uncertain, which is why as a teacher, I encourage you to develop the perception of light with these nimittas. Whatever the experience, if you really want to, if you train yourself, if you incline towards it, if it's a real nimitta, it's not hard to perceive it as a light. And if you do perceive it as a light, it's much more easy to work with. Number one, it's very easy to know whether it's a real nimitta or a fake nimitta. If it's a feely-feely one, it could be a fake one. But if it's a light one, it's very easy to deal with. And also because as human beings, we have much more experience with visual objects. You know, as adults, we're a visual person. We know most of our brain is taken up with visual sensations. So we're very good with visions, with lights. Which means when we do get to an emitter, if we can perceive it similar to a light, we can do much more with it. We can really get into it. And we can mess around with it. We know where we are. We can get much better feedback, so it develops. Which is why if you do get to that stage, the breath disappears, and you feel very good, but you can't see a light, just train yourself. Look for a light. There's a light there. And you'll soon see it. And it's worthwhile developing the light perception because it is much easier to deal with and to see where you are and how you go. You don't waste so much time. So that's why the light one. With the light, it does not matter what color it is. The color is what you add to it. Remember, these are all perceptions, green, blue, yellow, pink. I don't care what your light color is. There's one guy, there's only one guy, actually there's two now. He saw a black nimitta. And when the first time he described it, I've never seen a black nimitta. I said, what did it look like? He said, well, it's just incredibly deep black. It was like satin. It was incredibly beautiful, but it was black. I said, okay, that's good. Because it didn't really matter that it was black. It was its depth, its power, its beauty. That was what I was looking for. The color is immaterial. So if you see these nimittas, if they're really deep, if they are, say, a blue nimitta or a yellow nimitta, once it gets powerful, it's like a blue which you will never see in this world. More deep, more intense than anything which the eye can see. Now that's the characteristic of these nimittas. Yeah, they're sort of blue, but not like any blue you see. Very rich, very deep, very powerful, incredibly beautiful. That is a sign of a nimitta. Now sometimes, the other thing I want to say with nimittas, sometimes it's amazing how negative people are and how they've got low self-esteem, even you guys as well. So much so when the nimitta first comes up, you come and see me and say, well, I saw this light, but it can't be a nimitta. Not me. I'm only a girl. I've only just started meditating. You know, I'm not a real Buddhist, I'm just sort of interested in meditation, it can't be me. It's just this incredible sort of lack of self-esteem, thinking, oh, I can't get nimittas, maybe monks, maybe nuns, maybe these people who've been keeping 8 precepts and hanging around the Buddhist society for years and years and years, this is my first retreat. But this is accumulated experience of a meditation teacher. 99% of time, when you think you've seen a nimitta, it is a nimitta. You can give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Because I knew that was a problem, that sometimes people, they see a light, think, no, it must be the moon, it must be the sun, it must be a flashlight, it must be the headlight of a car shining at me, it can't be a nimitta, not me. That's why, you see how we've designed this hall? There are no windows. No car headlights can come into this room. The glass is not clear and it's high up. And many of you, you're facing this way, you're not facing the window. So when a light comes up in this room, it is a nimitta. It's not the sun. It's not the moon. It's not a flashlight. It's not a headlight. It is real. Give yourself a break. You've got a nimitta. Well done. It's amazing how many people are down upon it. It can't be a nimitta. Not me. It is. Enjoy. Well done. Sometimes a nimitta's come up. The whole body hasn't disappeared totally yet. It still can hear sounds in the distance, but you're calm. Yeah, nimitta's come up. The mind is starting to manifest itself. Well done. Enjoy it. Shh. Be still with it. And see if it can stabilize and grow. It'll give you lots of peace and lots of happiness and lots of joy. Don't worry about what color it is. Any color will do. Don't worry about how intense it is. It'll soon get intense. Just be still. Allow it to develop. Don't concern yourself if it's moving. If you try and stop it, you're doing something and move even more. Just stand back, be still, relax, imagine yourself as Ajahn Chah. But still forest pool, let it happen. If it's complicated, go to the most beautiful part of it, which simplifies the whole thing. Never be afraid. If you get a scary nimitta, have fun with it. And if you can do that, you will develop these nimittas. And when they come, you won't reject them, and you really start getting into deep states of meditation. And what happens next? That's what you'll find out tomorrow. In the next episode of A Hitchhiker's Guide to Enlightenment. So, are there any questions about nimittas? Yeah. Yes, I try to mention that just at the very end. You're asking, you know, can you have the nimittas appear before the breath has totally disappeared? Of course, yes. Because what the nimitta is, you know, it's the sixth sense consciousness becoming strong. What you're actually seeing there is the mind, the jitta. That's what the nimitta is. That's how you experience it. For those who know your suttas, that's stage 9 of the Anapanasati Sutta, 16 steps. You are aware of the jitta. Chitta pati sang vedeti. You experience the jitta. That's this beautiful light which you see. Now, what happens to many people if you're doing a lot of meditation, or the alternative, if you're a very good person, really generous, really kind, really compassionate? Those three things, now dana, sila, compassion, metta, those three things really make you have a very, very strong mind. Which means the energy of your mind is already pretty, pretty intense. So much so that maybe your five senses haven't totally been subdued, but the mind's intensity is so big that you can see the mind even though there's some remnant of the five senses left. It's like an amplitude problem. Usually, the five senses have got so much of your energy. They're really strong. And you can't even perceive the mind. It's just so weak. But, you know, with good spiritual practice, you know, really being kind, being really, really generous, looking after Jhana Grove with your donations, looking after the nuns' monastery. This is not just getting money. This is getting nimittas as well. It's just your attitude is actually what makes this strong mind. This beautiful attitude, you know, not being selfish, helping other people, forgiving people when they bang the doors. That type of mind is so beautiful. It gives lots of energy. Negative, and getting stingy, getting grumpy, you stupid woman, you're supposed to be the caretaker, take care of this place more. That type of mind, you're taking energy out of your nimitta. You're making it very hard. You're fault-finding. You're negative. So if you've got a very beautiful mind, the energy of your mind naturally is very, very high. So when the amplitude of the five senses decreases and decreases, decreases, the nimitta appears very early. And because of that, sometimes, yes, it's true. You're still watching the breath, and you still hear sounds, but you can see a light coming up. It's a sign your mind is very beautiful and very strong. And sometimes it happens. If you really get into this meditation and start getting a few jhana experiences, sometimes the nimitta stays with you, even when you're having lunch. You've got the beautiful light in front of you and you're actually looking through it to eat your food. It's no joke, that's that strong sometimes. You know, it just never leaves you. Because all it is, your mind is incredibly powerful. And more powerful than your five senses in that. Now, well, you've already subdued the five senses a lot, but your five senses are enough to eat the food, but the mind is just incredibly strong. Yeah.
I was going to say, if you have an imitator and the breath at the same time, what's the best thing to focus on?
Nothing. Focus. You want to focus on anything. Focus on the person who's watching and keep it still. Okay. Shh. Don't do anything. Shh. Don't even say shh. That's doing too much. So just, you learn how to be still. If it's the right time, the nimitta will just grow and it will just block out the breath. If it's not the right time, nimitta will disappear and the breath will come back. You just have to follow nature. You can't get involved. Yeah? When you're walking, if you start to see a nimitta when you're walking, it's very rare, but again, you have to look through the nimitta to make sure you don't hit the wall. This is a story I tell because the same question comes up every retreat. Can you get into the deep meditations in walking meditation? I always thought you can't. If you start to see a nimitta, even when you're walking meditation, sit down, even in the middle of the walking path, and just focus on the nimitta, and sit down and develop the nimitta, rather than trying to walk. Because it will take away all your attention of what you're doing when you're walking, and you keep banging into the wall. I always thought that was impossible to do, but one of the monks in Thailand told me, yes, there was one monk who used to get into jhanas when he was doing walking meditation. He's just a powerful mind, he just gets totally focused, lose all sense of the five senses, and go into the realm of the mind. And you could tell that he had so many bruises and cuts on his face. He's always bumping into things because he was meditating there and he didn't know where he was going, he just kept bumping into the wall and falling over. Of course, he didn't feel himself bumping into the wall and falling over because it's in jhana, but when he come out afterwards, oh, this hurts. So if you're someone like that and you start getting nimittas on the walking meditation path, please come and see me and we'll get you crash helmet, padding. So you just go for your life, and if you bang into something, you won't get hurt. It's cool.
You've described meditation as an emotional journey.
And oh, yeah.
Jhana factors are emotional factors.
Yeah.
So wouldn't a feeling
nimitta
be more in tune with the whole
thing? Okay. Yeah, saying that the meditation is an emotional thing, so it wouldn't be a feeling nimitta be more appropriate. It's in my experience of feeling nimittas is very, very hard to know exactly where you are and what's going on. Because we don't have as much experience with feelings as we have with visions. You know, even like sometimes you go to see a doctor and you say, it hurts. Describe the pain. And it's so difficult to describe pain. You know, there's a million different types of pains. And the poor doctors say, well, it hurts. Whereabouts? Well, somewhere around here somewhere. What does it hurt? Well, it hurts. Is it burning pain, itching pain? Yeah, that's sort of. And the poor doctor doesn't actually know what type of pain it is. And it's the same with joy and happiness. How many types of happiness and joy do we know? It's difficult because we haven't got vocabulary. For sight, we have got vocabulary. That's why it's much easier. Talking about an emotional, that's because even when you see these beautiful nimittas, incredibly bright, and they're always accompanied by very, very strong feelings of happiness and joy and love. I was one of the other times that everybody sees a nimitta. So don't worry, if you haven't seen one yet, don't worry, you will, when you die. You go towards the light. You've heard many people say the stories of near-death experiences. You go towards the light. What is death anyway? You're letting go of the body, the five senses are stopping. That's what the light is. When you die, it's exactly the same thing you do in meditation, but in meditation, you know, you're alive to come back and tell me about it afterwards. But many people, I've always read these experiences, and sometimes they emerge into that light for a while. And they give these experiences, pure love, total peace, oh, just the one with all things, you know, just union with God. Myself is not there anymore. And you can see just how they're trying to stretch to get a vocabulary for that incredibly intense emotional experiences of those stages and jhana stages. So this is actually gives you an indication of the sorts of emotional experiences you will have at this stage. Pure love, never experienced, just a love with all things. Incredible bliss. This is it. This is God consciousness. Whatever it is. Incredibly intense, and sometimes if you're not emotionally mature enough, you just can't handle that. You get afraid. The emotional intensity. And also to be able to take happiness and joy and love and peace. These are emotional states. And what you are aware of is not just the light, but it is the emotion as well. Fear and excitement you have to let go of. Allowing yourself to be happy, which is very difficult for many people. Blissfully happy is very tough. You know why? Because many people think, I don't deserve it. I'm not a good person. If Ajahn Brahm only knew what I'd do when I get home. And because of that negativity, that's why a lot of people block the nimittas. So, you deserve it. Okay? You deserve it. You deserve it. There's one person here. To help them with their meditation, last time they were on a retreat, I gave them a certificate. A happiness license, which I signed on headed note paper. I hereby allow this person to be happy for no particular reason at any time, signed Ajahn Brahm.
One more question.
Yeah.
In the Anapanasati Sutta, the word is chitta.
Yeah.
Nimitta is like commentarial. Why didn't the Buddha use samadhi nimitta once in the Sutta?
No. This is actually, somebody sent me an article by Ajahn Sona, roughly about the same sort of argument. I said, hang on, that's not right, because in the classic sutta, it's the Upakalesa Sutta, where the Buddha talks about the problems with nimittas, all the different refined hindrances to actually having a nimitta and overcoming it. Unfortunately, that's one place where Bhikkhu Bodhi didn't do a good translation. And he says, in every one of those problems to developing the nimitta, it says what the problem is, like excitement, like fear, like too much energy, too little energy. And he says afterwards, and the meditator didn't understand the reason or the cause for that. And the actual word is tang nimittang napati vijati. He didn't penetrate that nimitta. The nimitta is actually used in this classic sutta which describes the nimitta stage of meditation, how to overcome the problems to get into the jhana. It's a translation problem. If you actually look at that sutta, the Upakalesa Sutta, in Pali, I think was it 18, I think, Upakalesas. I could be wrong on that. There's 18 of them, and everyone, it says, that nimitta, you don't penetrate and go through the problem. So that's where it's used, in the place you'd most expect it. In the one sutta where the Buddha describes the nimitta stage of meditation and how to overcome those refined defilements which stop you getting to jhana. If you want to, I can show it to you afterwards. Okay, so now you have those instructions. Now, don't crave the nimitta. Now say, wow, I'm going to do this. This is it. Right. Okay, nimitta, come on. That is the danger of me talking like this. When you start to talk about intense energy, intense bliss, this is where you get psychic powers, you can feel the power. How many of you? Yeah, I want that. These are stages of letting go. This is what happens when you let things go, when you're still. Please don't crave the nimittas. Develop the stillness. If you're still, the nimittas will come. So your job is to develop stillness, not to develop nimittas. Develop stillness. See how still you can become. And this is what will happen. Okay, very good. Now we have interviews. So, before we have interviews, what do we do? Sadhu! Sadhu! Sadhu!